All right, welcome to church today. It's so lovely to see all these beautiful faces today. My name is Daniel. For those of you who don't know me, if you're new, would love to connect with you after service today. So feel free to come up and introduce yourself to me. We actually have a guest speaker today. We have a dear friend of mine named Hudi Mansell, who will be preaching for us today, diving into the book of Ruth, but also bridging kind of in his sermon into some of the work that he and his wife do with New Hope Community Services out in Surrey, a beautiful organization that helps welcome and settle refugees here in Canada. And Hudi is just the most fascinating individual, one of the most fascinating individuals I've ever met. He just, you know, he comes up, you'll see, he just looks cool, and he just is able to do a myriad of things like run ultra marathons and skateboard and also working on completing a PhD all in the midst of all of that. So why don't you give a warm welcome to Hudi. Hudi, why don't you come on up? And I'd be happy to pray for you and then release you to share. Father, just thank you for Hudi. Thank you for the gift that he is to the local church, the gift that he is to individuals who are in places of despair and fear and difficulty. And just pray that you would just continue to sustain him in the calling that you've called him to. Thank you for the gift that he is to all the individuals that come across his path and his kind and tender heart to people. As he shares with us today, may we be challenged and encouraged today to make closer steps to following you, Jesus, in your way. Pray this in Christ's name. Amen.
So it's nice to see Pastor Daniel in his natural habitat. Because I know he was really excited about coming here, and I was watching this from a distance, and I was like, oh, this could be interesting. You know, he's from Alberta, or he's recently from Alberta. You know that, right? So it's going to take a little while to work that out of him. But I think he's, you know, he's teachable. So I trust you to transform him. So so we're gonna be nerding out a little bit this morning. But there's a little something for everybody. So there's some heart stuff, and there's some stuff for your brain. If you're a bit of a scholar and a nerd, there's some things for you too. And we're going to jump all over the place, and hopefully something will resonate. But if you're not tracking with all of it, that's perfectly cool, perfectly good. You don't need to. So just take what you can and leave the rest, okay? So I don't know if it's your custom here or not, but if something feels unclear, you could just fire up your hand and ask a question, and I'm totally cool with that. I'm totally open with that, and it won't offend me. It'll be nice. So I don't know. Is that cool here?
Sure.
Okay. So I'm kind of calling this reading other people's texts. Anybody here part of a family group chat on WhatsApp or something like that? Yeah, those are fun, eh? I think somebody should just like collate those or turn those into like a book. And you're just like, oh my gosh, this family needs help. But we're going to be looking at some of the Hebrew traditions group family chats, and they're a little ugly and they're a little messy and they're also really, really beautiful. And so that's what we're going to be covering. So I hear you've been reading the lovely romantic tale of Ruth. That's what it is, right? It's a quaint, almost Amish version of love set in the Wild West of the time of the Judges, right? This must be an authentic snapshot into biblical romance. It's kind of classic. Girl meets exotic foreign guy. Guy dies, now widowed, follows her cranky mother-in-law back to her xenophobic homeland, passes herself off as a slave farm worker, catches the eye of a wealthy landowner, who she is instructed to seduce by telling him he has a legal obligation. Definitely Jewish foreplay there. He keeps it kosher, though. They get married, they have a baby, and live happily ever after, right? That's what this story is. Kind of strange to imagine that Hallmark hasn't picked this up yet, right? Actually, that would be really great. I would watch that. Or maybe that's not what this story is about. Maybe it's about something else, or maybe it's actually about a number of things. And I know Pastor Daniel has been walking you through much of that already, and I think at some point soon you'll make a good case for Jesus-like characters in the story. Okay, maybe did I just spoil it? Okay, so I just spoiled it. Sorry about that. But this story is a cornerstone of the greater Jewish story and has had a lively, interpretive existence outside of that for a long, long time. And so while I will reference the New Testament, most of what I will cover here will be about the story of Ruth in its immediate literary world. Because texts that we read in our scriptures do not exist in isolation. They're part of a really big conversation of a whole bunch of other texts, and there's disagreements, and there's stories, and there's debates, and there's conflicting and contradictory ideas that are working against each other, kind of like one of those messy family group chats. There is no such thing as a singular biblical theology or a singular biblical history, but there's a whole bunch of different streams that come together into an amazing, amazing, cohesive, and beautiful story. But there are many voices, we say polyphonic, many voices in the Hebrew Bible. And it's a vibrant family discussion. And it's kind of like that story of Christmas when Uncle Gary showed up drunk and tried to teach the nieces and the nephews how to golf with a spatula and a Christmas bulb, and there was something about a guinea pig. And we all tell this story, but everybody has a slightly different version of what went down. They're all true, but we all have a different slice of it. And we all kind of go, oh yeah, Uncle Gary. But we all have a different take on what actually happened. So I personally, as a Bible scholar, as a Hebrew scholar, I kind of giggle to myself when I hear people say, well, that's what the Bible says. That settles it. I'm like, dude, did you even read the thing? And yes, there are consistent themes and arcs, and they're beautiful, but there's a whole lot more wooliness and wonder and disagreement and counter-arguments. And the book of Ruth is no exception. In fact, it is one of the best and my favorite examples of this. It is in dialogue with Genesis and Exodus and Leviticus and Deuteronomy and Joshua and Judges and Ezra and Samuel and reaching back. Matthew is in dialogue with the book of Ruth. And then early in Christian history, there's other books that are referencing it and people are talking about it all the time. It's part of a big, huge, beautiful family dialogue. If you're a bit of a tech nerd, it's like a nodes in a network. Texts operate in relation to one another, or as tables in a distributed database. So let's try to situate Ruth's place in the network, and I'm sure Daniel has covered this a bit, but just as a bit of a refresher, the story of the book of Ruth is set in the 11th or 12th century BC. The time of the judges. I think that's fairly clear from the story. The book was composed in the form that we presently read it around the 5th century BC. So that's a bit of a distance between that and what we like to call the Persian period. This is kind of like when we watch Downton Abbey, not that I've ever done that, and which is set between 1912 and 1926. With every effort to be authentic and real, with language and styles and historical references and even authentic-looking newspapers, but we all know that it was made in 2010 to 2022, and there's a third movie on the way. But none of us are excited. But back to Ruth and the Persian period. The temple is being rebuilt. That's pretty cool. A dude named Ezra, who's a priest sort of leader, and scribe, and Nehemiah and Zerubbabel are kind of big name characters in this story. Rabbinic Judaism, which is going to become very, very important in the years to come around the time of Jesus. We see Rabbinic Judaism is kind of like thriving. That's developing at this time, largely led by the dude named Ezra. And the Samaritan religion, which is we're going to explain in a second, is also arising and emerging at this time. And also priest-led Judaism is continuing. There's multiple streams of the Jewish world that are growing alongside each other with competing and arguing and debating worlds within them. So we're going to shift a little and talk about some theology for a second to lay a foundation of what it means to become attached to the Hebrew people at this time in the story of Ruth, and particularly to the tribe of Judah. So we're going to talk about the word ger. This is a very important word, ger. We like to translate this sometimes in our Bibles as the sojourner, as somebody who comes from somewhere else, or somebody who lives alongside of. And because I assume that a lot of you are Christians, you draw your religious legacy and your religious story from the Hebrew Bible and from the Jewish people. And so some of these background words and these ideas are very, very important to understand what we're talking about. So ger is a very important word. Most scholars right now in the Hebrew and in linguistics, we really struggle to say that we probably shouldn't try to translate this word anymore. It should exist by itself as it is, as ger, and use that in English to capture this wonderful and beautiful essence of the person who lives in a society that is not their native home, and they've made it their native home. And we'll talk about refugees in a little bit. It has a wide semantic range. So in our Hebrew Bible, to be a foreigner, to reside, it has verbal forms, to live. We see it in the beginning of the book of Ruth, where it talks about Naomi and her husband Elimelech and their son, their charming sons Mahlon and Kilion, weakly and sickly, charming, went to Legor in the land of Moab. They went to live or to sojourn or to be temporary. In Exodus, we have some wonderful texts, and I'll translate these either myself or we use different translations, but Exodus 23, you do not oppress the ger. You yourselves are acquainted, this is what it literally says, you are acquainted with the soul of a ger, or you are intimately connected, because you were gerim in Egypt. That's your story, that's the Hebrew legacy. You are that, so your soul is connected with that. Deuteronomy lumps the idea of the fatherless and the widow and the ger together over and over and over. Do not deprive the ger or the fatherless of justice or take the cloak of a widow as a pledge. Leviticus has, when a foreigner or a ger resides among you in the land, do not mistreat them. The ger residing among you must be treated as your native born. Love them as yourself. That's heavy. That's intense. For you were gerim in Egypt, I am the Lord your God. It's beautiful. I think about this a lot. Then later we have language, we won't read this one, but we have language that equates the practicing of sorcery with those who rip off their workers, Amazon, and those who undermine the ger, right? Like that's amazing. Like to say that like you practice sorcery and you don't pay, you'd pay just above minimum wage. Those are kind of the same things, or you don't take care of the foreigner in your midst. Crazy, eh? This is a totally different value system than what we see operating in the West. Okay? And Jeremiah, there's a beautiful text there. I'll read this, actually. Yeah, I'll read it. This is a later text. And it says, do not put your trust in illusions and say, the temple of God, the temple of God, the temple of God are these buildings. No, if you really mend your ways and your actions, if you execute justice between one party and the other, if you do not oppress the ger, the orphan and the widow, if you do not shed the blood of the innocent in this place, if you do not follow other gods to your own hurt, then only will I let you dwell in this place, in the land I gave to your ancestors of all time. And this is my little shout at Christian Zionism. We have here a text, we reference Jeremiah all the time, oh, prophecies, return, all these beautiful things about the land and going back to the land. But if you don't take care of the people in the land, if you oppress the others, the foreigners, the sojourner, the ger, you don't have a right to be there. And we're not getting into the Israeli-Palestinian conflict today. We'll put that out there, though. So we're going to keep this all in mind as we go back to Ezra. So remember what we said about Uncle Gary? There's more to this conversation in other facets. So when we turn to Deuteronomy, The second law, we read this. This is kind of wild. No Ammonite or Moabite or any of their descendants may enter the assembly of the Lord, not even in the 10th generation. Ooh. For they did not come out to meet you with bread and water on your way when you came out of Egypt. They hired Baalam, the son of Beor, of Pethor, of Aram, Naharim, to pronounce a curse on you. Do not seek a treaty of friendship with them as long as you live. Yikes. This is pretty straightforward and absolutist. 10 generations is technically 300 to 400 years, but it's really actually means forever, like typologically. And when this code, when this text of Deuteronomy was codified or finalized, this is in about the 7th century, so about 400 years after the events described about Baalam. But Deuteronomy also preserves another tradition within its own text. So this is nerdy stuff. With another point where the people of Moab did welcome the newcomers as they were coming through the land, and that's in Deuteronomy 2. That's your homework. You can do that on your own time. And Deuteronomy also contains more instructions about justice for the orphan and the widow and the ger than any of the other books of the Torah. I find that interesting. So the coexistence of competing traditions suggests that there was a growing debate even in the book of Deuteronomy and reflects that there were different attitudes over time. So what's really going on here? Well, it technically isn't polite to air the family's laundry in public, but because you've been reading our group texts and you've heard about Uncle Gary already and his shenanigans, I should probably read you in on the details. So we'll go to some details. We're going to go ahead a fair bit there, I think. Yeah. Well, you got it. That was it. Go back. Yay! Okay, awesome. So, here's context. 722, Assyrian captivity. Those grumpy Assyrians came, they deported and broke up much of the northern kingdom of Israel, and they exiled chunks of the population, with the exception of the poor rural folk. Keep that in mind. And these are left to settle in the land, what we later call Samaria. They are agrarian, they grow things, they're farmers, and they are the poor country folk. So that kind of goes on, it does its thing, it's kind of quiet. And then 586, a little ways later, the Babylonians are like, hey, you know, let's take Judah. That would be kind of fun. And Benjamin, of course, because Benjamin kind of always goes along with Judah like a little brother. The elite, the educated, and the wealthy of Judah and Benjamin and some of the priests and Levites were taken away to Babylon. We call that the Babylonian exile or the Babylonian captivity. So again, this is really interesting. The poor and the rural folk of Judah and Benjamin are resettled and left in the land. They're not considered good enough to be taken all along, and they're resettled in the north, largely in Samaria. Okay? So and this is kind of like a Babylonian pattern, and the Assyrians did it too. And to some degree, the people, and they also moved in other people, but the people intermarried with other people in the region at this point in time in history. There's not a lot of what we would call traditional Canaanites or Perizzites or Jebusites or all those other ites. Those don't really exist in a way that we would understand it from, like, say, the book of Judges or Joshua or Exodus. Those things have changed. So these northern Hebrews, these northern Israelites, kind of just keep trucking along, okay? They have preserved a Torah. They have their own version of Torah. It's kind of like the Masoretic text or the Hebrew Torah that we have today, but it's a little different too, and it's got some sort of like really funky little things in it that are really fun to study. That's another family scandal for another day. But anyway, so... But they kind of like keep going along. They build a temple in Gerizim, and they like make sacrifices up there. And to this day, there are still Samaritans doing their thing up in northern Israel. All 500 of them, I think. And so these Judahites, who are later called Jews, return from Babylon. Again, they're urbanized. They're educated. And now they're really kind of hip and cool because they got like some Babylonian and some Persian things going on, and they have like the new fashion, and they got that kind of, and they have this sort of contempt for the country folk. And they give them a name, the Am Haaretz, the people of the land. the country rednecks or the Albertans. And they were intermarried, and this was an issue for them. Okay? And it seems that at some point in time that the returnees also intermarried with the people of the land, the Am Ha'aretz, and this mix of people that is around. These Am Ha'aretz appear to be opposed to building the temple in Jerusalem, though not entirely. And reading between the lines, they were threatened by how these newcomers were threatening the status quo, and they were backed by the Persian court. They had money, they had resources, and they came back into the land saying, this is our land, we're doing this thing, we're building this temple, and they were disrupting the status quo. And these Am Ha'aretz were also equally threatening to Ezra, who, as a reformer, was trying to spark a revival and renewal of interest in the Torah, the Hebrew first five books of Moses, and he was very concerned with purity. Purity is a major theme for Ezra, and he wants the community to be pure and the temple to be pure, and he sees these as very important ingredients for being able to continue to stay and to build this new world, and he's going to become the OG of what is Rabbinic Judaism in the years to come, and the dominant force of Judaism. So we see around this time, we start to see the term Samaritan pop up to describe these northern peoples. The Am Ha'aretz are now not known as the Am Ha'aretz, but they're also known as the Samaritans, and these terms begin to be used interchangeably, which is fascinating. So, and it's derisive. Samaritan was not like, hey, that's a cool name. It was like, you know, Albertan. So when we read Ezra, I think this is in chapter 4, and when the enemies of Judah and Benjamin, talk about the Samaritans or the Am Ha'aretz, heard that the exiles were building the temple for the Lord, the God of Israel, they came to Zerubbabel and to the heads of the families and said, let us help you build. This is really interesting. Because, like you, we seek your God and have been sacrificing to him since the time of Esarhaddon, king of Assyria, who brought us here. Okay? But Zerubbabel, Joshua, and the rest of the heads of the families of Israel answered, you have no part in building the temple to our God. We alone will build it for the Lord, the God of Israel, as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, commanded us. Then the people around them set out to discourage the people of Judah, to make them afraid to go on building. They bribed the officials to work against them and frustrate their plans during the entire reign of Cyrus, king of Persia, down to the reign of Darius, king of Persia. So this is kind of wild, eh? I mean, maybe we've read this before, but there's actually something really interesting. They offered to help, they're rejected, and they're saying, like, we're gonna follow your God. We follow your God too. We've actually already been doing this. We actually have a temple. Can we join in? And the response is, no, you have no part of us. So they get grumpy and they get angry and they start a WhatsApp group and start yelling, and this flame war goes back and forth between the Samaritans back to Persia and Persia back to the Samaritans and the Judahites back to Persia, and it's kind of yucky. And Ezra and his temple project win the day, and the bitterness remains. What is striking to me is one of the names of the people that was in this group of Samaritans or this group of the Am Ha'aretz, and his name is Tovia, or Tobias Ha'amoni, the Ammonite. Tovia means Yah is good. His parents named him that because they were followers of the God of Israel, and yet having Ammonite background. And sometimes the people we fight the hardest are the people from our own family and our own clans and our own. And these guys weren't pagan outliers. So let me just recap really quickly, because if you're going like, what the heck is going on here? This marginalized community, the Samaritans, the Am Ha'aretz, are not considered important enough to be deported. Twice. That's got to hurt your feelings. Like, why don't we get to be in part of the deportation? They remain in the land. They remain faithful to God, to the best of our knowledge. They do their thing. They find their groove. They worship God in their own way. Then this elite group returns back 70 years with the blessing and the cash of the Persian king. They're disrupting the status quo, especially with their newfound religious zeal and orthodoxy. It's not racism, but it's prejudice and it's distrust of the other. So on the Jewish side, the Jews from Judah, a religious political campaign is launched, a three-pronged approach, Torah, Deuteronomy in particular, temple, build, baby, build, ethnic and ritual purity. So this becomes very important. So when we read this text in Ezra 9, this is kind of heavy. So remember, this is all about Ruth, actually. Ruth is still the thing that's in the background here. After all these things had been done, the leaders came to me and said, "The people of Israel, including the priests and Levites, have not kept themselves separate from the neighboring peoples with their detestable practices, like those of the Canaanites, Hittites, Perizzites, Jebusites, Ammonites, Moabites, Egyptians, and Amorites. They have taken some of the daughters as wives for themselves and their sons, and they have mingled the holy race with the peoples around them, and the leaders and the officials have led the way in this unfaithfulness. When I heard this," this is Ezra, "I tore my tunic and cloak and pulled my hair from my head and beard and sat down appalled. Then everyone who trembled at the words of God of Israel gathered around me because of this unfaithfulness of the exiles, and I sat there appalled until the evening sacrifice." So if you know this story well, there's a big call to repentance, and there's a call to divorce or put away the foreign women from amongst these Jewish exiles, and some of whom had children together. These were families. These were people that were connected. And the people they were married to were people that were distantly related anyway. Our texts don't describe exactly what happened, but they leave us with the impression that this is how it went down. The wives were divorced. With what we know about the ancient Near East, and maybe you've kind of got the sense with the story of Ruth, as that to be a woman at that time, unattached to a protective male, was a very, very precarious place to be. It's a very, very unsafe world in that way. And so when we have this idea of all these families being torn apart, that's actually a really dark, dark thing and deeply troubling. So what blows my mind is, from our historical work on this, is we don't actually see the presence of Ammonites, except for like some old names. We don't see these pagan groups or these Canaanite groups even existing really anymore. These are essentially related peoples that follow the God of Israel. So Ezra, in his words, he's drawing on archetypes or old animosities of the inhabitants of the land at the time of the conquest, hundreds and hundreds of years before. So knowing that this is likely the world that the Book of Ruth emerges in is really, really important. I heard one commentator who spoke of Ruth as a story that was whispered amongst these shattered families, amongst these shattered women, that was passed person to person among the returnees, of giving a message of hope to each other. It's not the end of the story. There's more to this. This is not how this works. Here's a beautiful story of how God actually sees us. And this is the image I hold in my heart, and this is the hope that I draw from this story. So to clarify, the Amharites, the Samaritans, are threatened, and they try to impede the Jews. Okay, so what I was thinking about this. So I think what I'm kind of sensing is that when Josiah brings this forth, we fast forward, 200 years later, 300 years later, this is the renewed efforts that Ezra is trying to tap into. He's trying to tap into that stream of revival that Josiah had brought. And Deuteronomy is really the text we think that was emerged at that time, or the second law, or that second type of giving. So I always connect Josiah with Ezra, like a sort of a leapfrog of history or a consistent theme. Does that make sense? Yeah, thanks. Okay, thank you for that. So if you're feeling a little confused about how this all fits with the Gare, you're not alone, because it doesn't really fit entirely, does it? So the writer of Ruth, she goes out of her way to remind us that Ruth is Moabite 6 times, that's a lot for four chapters. It's actually starting to get awkward by that point. Like, say it once, say it twice, maybe introduce her at the beginning of the story, but if you keep saying it over and over and over, you're trying to make a point. And so we're paying attention. So in our story of Ruth, if you haven't noticed, our characters are not Torah scholars. They kind of misunderstand the laws of levirate marriage. Did you find that kind of confusing? You're like, is that really how that works? Yeah, no, it's not how it works. And so they seem to have some confusion about that. They don't understand Torah in the sense of biblical land transfers and inheritance. That's also confusing. And then they conflate that with the laws of levirate marriage. Like, that's the brother thing where you... Okay, and... but they are not confused about chesed. They are not confused about loving kindness and mercy. They are not confused about love. And in our story, as you've been reading it, chesed wins at every turn. Chesed trumps law. And the best part of that it takes is a plucky Moabite woman who insists on justice to inspire everyone else around her to live up to the best of the Hebrew ideal. I love that so much. It taps into the ethnic origins of King David, the most loved Judahite king. That's very significant, right? Because this is generally the snotty people in our bigger story are the Judahites. And I love the Judahites. That's probably the tribe I'm from. They're great. But David actually went to go hang out and hide out with his Moabite family. Isn't that crazy? It's like, this is Greek grandpa and grandma that were living there in Moab when he was fleeing King Saul. The story didn't quite go right, but whatever. The story of Ruth gives us the imagination of what actually could be and how outsiders can be integrated into our society, our family, and our story. One of the things that strikes me in my work on the book of Ruth is that she can't yet bring herself and her story and the way she refers to herself to even use the term ger or gera to describe herself. She doesn't use that. Instead, she uses this really negative, horrible term, nachria or nochria, which means like this really unclean, dangerous foreigner. That's how she, self-deprecating, she refers to herself as that, holy outside. Then later in the story, she refers to herself as servant or slave, shifoteach. And then she kind of turns to amateach, which is like, kind of like a maidservant. And that's really significant. And then she is retitled. I love this, and maybe you've already covered this. She's retitled by Boaz as Eshet Chayil. Warrior woman. I just love that. Not only does she find compassion, but she is elevated and honored and cherished. This is such a brilliant contrast to the Ezra sort of attitude. It's like the ideal is being embodied. The ideal that all those texts we read about honoring the ger and loving the ger as yourself, all of a sudden, Ruth embodies that love and embodies that that connection and that meaning. So, and practically, I love the book of Ruth because it doesn't answer or attack the debates about legitimacy or insider-outsider status with theology or strongly written letters to a foreign king or polemics. It answers that debate with a beautiful story. It tells a sweet and powerful story of embodied chesed, embodied loving kindness. And it's imperfect. It's imperfect Torah. It's imperfect law. But it still is like the final word. There's no threats of violence. There's no families being destroyed. There's families being built. So this informs me of how I want to live in my world. And I often think, as a Jewish person, of how do I embody Torah? How do I embody the best of the Hebrew culture and the Hebrew tradition and then my family's tradition? How do I embody that best? Because a lot of Torah feels a little abstract sometimes. Like, do I really want to wear like side locks? That seems kind of strange, and I don't know how that means anything anymore, and I have some problems with hair as it is. what do I do? Like, how do I live embodied Torah? And this is where I'd like to introduce you to New Hope. So about 9 years ago, a congregation in Surrey had tasked me with starting a refugee sponsorship program. They figured, you lived in the Middle East, you should be able to figure this out. And that was not helpful in my case. And I entered a fascinating world, and eventually leading me and my family to live in a refugee resettlement home where we moved about 6 years ago. And I live there with my wife and daughter now. I have two grown sons now who aren't crazy about living in a tiny apartment with their parents. And I live there as the resident assistant and weekend and evening manager of chaos. We have two buildings now. One's in North Surrey, in Wally, and we have 13 suites there, and we just got keys to a second building in New West, where we have three suites available right now, and we just moved families in. The third family was moved in this week, and we have 11 more suites that will hopefully open up soon, so that's super, super cool. Our neighbors come to live with us for 18 months while they get on their feet. And rebuild their lives, learn some language, get jobs, find their expat community. All of our families have their own self-contained apartment, but we do a lot together. The kids are constantly gathered in the hallways gaming. I can't get into my apartment most days without stepping over a whole gaggle of children saying, hey guys, I need to get in here. And it's like the 1980s, everybody runs from house to house and smells poorly sometimes. Tween feet are awful. And twice a month, we enjoy a community meal together, and those are typically sponsored by different churches that just come alongside us, and then they send a little crew, and we have dinner together, and games, and hang out, and we have children's programs, and library programs, and we go to hockey games, and soccer games, and we play a lot. We have 26 children in the building right now, the building that I'm at, and the place just hums with activity. Our families at present are from Syria and Iraq and Kurdistan, Colombia, Venezuela, Afghanistan, Somalia, Ethiopia, and Uganda. So it's a real diverse and beautiful and fun place. It's my newcomer neighbors, who take their food bank food and distribute it to the unhoused and addicted people in my neighborhood? Are there the people that stay up all night caring for some guy who's passed out from fentanyl on our stoop just to make sure he stays breathing all night? Chesed. These are the people who might not speak English, but are volunteering at the nearby homeless shelter because Mr. Hootie, somebody needs to do something. Chesed. When my dearest friend passed away suddenly in 2021, I sat on the couch of my Iraqi friends sobbing as he held me, bonded over grief as his father had just passed as well. Chesed. When I lost 8 friends and colleagues on October 7th, my whole community was subjected to fresh anti-Semitic hate. My Christian friends were too afraid to say anything, but it was my neighbor Ahmed who came to me and said, I can't stop crying over the Jewish babies. And then he came to me to the vigils. These are the people who share food with me and the kids I have to step over. My neighbors teach me daily how to be a better human, a more generous and connected person. They embody chesed in so many ways, and that give me an opportunity to live out that in my own life. When I started this, it was goofy. I thought I would actually help people. And I did it out of duty and responsibility, but now I'm the one that's cared for. And we do help our families, we really do, and some of them are so decimated when they come to us and are carrying so much pain and so much trauma that they don't even have the energy to do anything but the bare survival. And we get that, and we're there for that, but statistically and anecdotally, newcomers make Surrey and Vancouver a safer, better place and should not be feared. Yeah, we need to be wise and we need to build infrastructure. We need to take care of the people. If we invite them to come, we have to build things for them to be here. But we do have more than enough to share. We really do. So when we see populist politicians on both sides of the border tapping into fear of newcomers, fear of others, They shame us into for abandoning our value of welcome, the value of chesed. So sometimes when we read the principles of Torah, we feel disconnect of how to live those out in our own lives, and I wonder about that, as I said. But with new hope, there's no disconnect for me. I'm connected. I get to witness and be part of chesed every day. So just take a quick peek back at our texts. We're going to fast forward from Ruth into Matthew. You know those insanely boring genealogies? They're good for something. Check this one. Abraham was the father of Isaac, Isaac the father of Jacob, Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers. This is sketchy. Judah, the father of Perez and Zerah by Tamar. Iffy story. The families that become the Moabites and the Ammonites. And Perez, the father of Hezron, Hezron, the father of Ram, Ram, the father of Amminadab, Amminadab, the father of Nachshon, Nachshon, the father of Salmon, and Salmon, the father of Boaz by Rahab. I love that. And Boaz, the father of Obed by Ruth, and Obed, the father of Jesse, and Jesse, the father of David the king, and David was the father of Solomon by the wife of Uriah, and Solomon, the father of Rehoboam, and so on. This is the genealogy of
Jesus.
So sometimes Jesus is the right answer. So Boaz, we're going back in time, Boaz, our mighty man of valor, one of the heroes of the Ruth story, not the only hero, the mighty man of valor is the son of Rahab. Who's Rahab? Where? Jericho. Hebrew? No. Foreigner? Yeah. Canaanite? Ugh. So perhaps this frames his sensitivity and his tenderness towards welcoming the outsider to live with a lively sense of Torah or chesed. Boaz's mom. That's so cool. Sometimes the first generation is the strongest. His mother had a sketchy work history as some form of sex worker, as we know. She was a pagan. She joined herself to Israel. It's one of those awkward moments at the family. So, how did you meet Grandma? But perhaps the darkest parts of our family histories are the very thing that God will use to teach us how to be compassionate and how to live by chesed and how to be holy. Beautiful things can happen when God redeems our stories. And we live... Thankfully, we live in a better trauma-informed world, sometimes a little trauma-obsessed, and we say things like, hurt people, and that's very, very true. But it is equally true that healed people heal people, and redeemed people redeem people. And much of my scholarly life and my personal life has been kind of connected with trauma, but there is life beyond trauma. Even my refugee friends who have escaped genocides and massacres and sexual violence and displacement on a scale that is incomprehensible, studies show, at least here in Vancouver, that about 80% of them will exhibit no signs of PTSD after 2 years. This is a really statistical wonder. Isn't that crazy? Isn't that wild? And studies show that there are layered reasons as to why, but one of the most significant factors is the sense. They've done some really big work here in Vancouver, especially to see why is it like this. And one of the biggest factors is the sense of welcome they receive in their new home. Isn't that crazy? So what I learned from this is that being a victim of terrible things is not our identity. Being a refugee is not an identity marker. It's a description of a person's circumstances in history. So my neighbors are fathers and mothers and sons and daughters. They're bricklayers and professors and poets and tribal nomads. They're musicians, they're scientists, they're soccer players, used car salesmen, and they're my friends. So just like the use of the word Ruth the Moabite, the use becomes more and more ironic as we get let in on the big twist. When she, in fact, becomes the mother of Obed, the great-grandmother of King David, the great-great-grandmother of Jesus. Now, as you may know, there are only four women mentioned in the genealogy of Jesus. Tamar, not Hebrew, sketchy. Rahab, not Hebrew, very dubious background. Ruth, not Hebrew, Moabite, God forbid. Bathsheba, wife of Uriah, Hebrew-ish. Some research being done on that would show that that Bathsheba was actually probably a Canaanite or of Canaanite descent. Long story, go for it in your own time. Is this a coincidence? The only four women mentioned in the genealogy of Jesus are all difficult other. And I think poor Ezra would melt down. I think he would just have a complete, he would be more than appalled. But perhaps the story of Ruth exists in this way to help us with humility, to make us aware that God uses broken pots and broken stories and broken people to do beautiful things, and that everyone who chooses to live by Torah is family. So as a scholar and as a faith person, I don't take Ezra to be prescriptive, just to be descriptive of a dark period of Jewish history. And we read it, we're like, yeah, the family group text, that wasn't the best moment. But we're all still here together. Here's the story. I'm going to stop there-ish. Yeah. There's a beautiful text in Isaiah 56, it's on the screen. And take this and maybe read this in your own time. But it's this beautiful thing where the prophetic vision is, there's going to be this time where the foreigner and the eunuch are going to be saying, I'm not kosher enough to be part of God's house, because that's what Ezra's concern was. You can't go into the temple. You can't go into the temple precinct unless you're pure. So foreigners and eunuchs, people who are physically broken and are relationally broken from the community, cannot enter God's house. But in Isaiah's vision here, the foreigners who are joined to God to render service and to love God's name, to be devoted servants, and all who keep my Sabbaths and don't profane it, I will bring them to my sacred mount and let them rejoice in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and sacrifices shall be welcome on my altar, for my house shall be called a house of prayer for all peoples. Radical inclusion. So some concluding thoughts, just to sum it all up. Maybe you can take one of these things, maybe you can take a couple of these things. Scripture can't be read in isolation. There's a big, huge, wonderful story going on and a big, huge collection of group texts. It's kind of fun. Not everything we read is prescriptive. Not everything we read is telling us what to do. It's just telling us kind of what was done. And sometimes it's like, oh man, we're so embarrassed about that. But it's there, and it's part of your story. It's part of your legacy too. Just don't forget Uncle Gary. When religious people behave badly out of fear, it's ugly. But on the inverse, when people thus embody God's intention for creation, even the mundane acts depicted in Ruth, building families, caring for the needy, welcoming the other, being accountable for one's prayers, these things gain redemptive significance. Uni Lee. God really cares about the Ger, and so should we. And our story, no matter what we've gone through or where we've come from or what we've experienced or the trauma that we carry or we're trying to slowly unload, that can be a source of chesed and it can be a source of God's redemption in our world around us. So let's not blame where we've come from, but look towards hope of God redeeming what we've come from. So new hope. We just got new keys, new building, closer to you. You want to come and join us or be part of what we're doing or adopt a dinner once every 8 months or something? That'd be cool. And there's some cool things happening, and that can be a way of expressing chesed. So thanks for listening to me. And I'll be out here somewhere after. You can bug me, talk to me. Father of mercy, thank you for your love. Thank you for the complex story that we're part of, the story of pushes and pulls and pain and loss and moments where we don't behave so well. Help us to behave with chesed, radical inclusion and tenderness. Help us to heal, and help us to heal others in turn. We love you. In your precious name, amen.